like to now turn the conference over to Penny Duckham. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to today's web briefing. As you know, this is an opportunity exclusively for journalists to focus today on what the Sustainable Development Goals mean for global health. And as in these previous webinars on global health issues, we are joined today by a great panel, and the opportunity here is to get an advanced sense of what some of the issues will be when the UN General Assembly meets in New York in a couple of weeks' time, and in particular when they focus on the Sustainable Development Goals. I am going to move very quickly to hand over to the panelists. I just want to remind you that if you could please send in any questions as we are talking, and then I will read out the questions and we will get to as many as we possibly can. The whole point of this is to cover as many questions as we can during the 1 hour presentation. So please send those in. And in the meantime, each of our presenters will talk for about 5 or so minutes. And we have slides which you can access on our, they've already been posted. If you want to click through them as we're discussing them, you can do that too. With that, I am going to hand over with many thanks to Tony Pipper, who's here with us in Washington, D.C. He is at the State Department and is the U.S. Special Coordinator for the Post-2015 Development Agenda. And everyone's bios are on our website, so I'm not going to go through his incredibly impressive bio. Over to you, Tony.
Thanks, Penny. So I'll just give an overview of where we've been going and how we've come to this agenda. Talk a little bit about the Millennium Development Goals and the differences between those and the new Sustainable Development Goals, and leave it at that. So for the last 3 years, the global community, which is really the UN and the member states within the UN, but also this has been a very transparent and inclusive process. It's involved also multilaterals, advocacy organizations, technical experts, private sector, have been engaged in a discussion about the set of goals to succeed the Millennium Development Goals. And as Penny mentioned, this will culminate in a Sustainable Development Summit later this month, preceding the UN General Assembly, where world leaders will formally adopt what is being called the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development. The rumor is that this will be the largest gathering of heads of state ever. And the U.S. was a real active participant throughout the negotiations on this agenda, which concluded in early August. As we transition from the Millennium Development Goals to the Sustainable Development Goals, just a word about the MDGs. The Millennium Development Goals were started in 2000 with an end date of 2015, hence the need for a successor framework. They were 8 goals, 21 targets, and really, while there are a number of forces that have contributed to the development gains of the last 25 years, the MDGs really have been a benchmark during a period of extraordinary progress in the fight against global poverty, hunger, disease. The world met the first MDG 5 years ahead of schedule, which was to cut in half the world's extreme poverty rate. Across the board, per capita incomes in the developing world have more than doubled over this period. And, you know, we have a child born today is twice as likely to survive into adolescence as in 1990. The MDGs, I think, really demonstrated the power of setting ambitious global goals. They really helped drive common action. They helped get everyone on the same page. They were focused on sort of a first order set of goals for the developing world, and they also demonstrated the value of global measurement. They really forced the global community to track progress against measurable targets and help highlight while we're falling short. And just for example, several years into the agenda, it was clear that globally we were coming up short on MDG 4, which was about child survival. And this realization prompted the 2012 Child Survival Call to Action, where the world came together to make a new pledge to end the deaths of children under 5, to prevent preventable child deaths under 5 by 2035. And as part of that international commitment, for example, the U.S. government and USAID made focused efforts in 24 countries, saving 500,000 children's lives in just 2 years. And we now know that 6 of the priority countries out of that effort have achieved MDG 4. So really, the MDGs were a benchmark in helping drive action and were really a symbol of what setting ambitious global goals could look like. Having said that, there were still gaps, and we've fallen short on what the original MDGs have set out. And this is a very dense slide, but the major point here is that gaps really persist. And as we went in to think about developing the set of sustainable development goals, we've incorporated those areas where we still have what we call the unfinished business of the MDGs. But as we talk about the differences between the MDGs and the SDGs, I'm going to hit on 3 major points. One is a difference of ambition. Another is the difference that political inclusivity has brought through that very inclusive, open, and transparent process. And the third is about integration. So when we look at the SDGs, we've gone from a set of 8 very discrete goals from the Millennium Development Goals and 21 targets to 17 goals for the Sustainable Development Goals and 169 targets. So that means they're more ambitious in size, where the MDGs were focused primarily on social development and poverty, education, health, and hunger. The SDGs broaden out to both environmental considerations, with environmental sustainability being a big part of it, as well as economic growth and economic activity. They also go deeper, whereas the MDGs, for example, on poverty were about a relative reduction, 50%. Now on some of those original MDGs, we're seeking to end things, to go to zero. So you see where in the goals we're trying to end extreme poverty, end preventable child and maternal mortality, come to an HIV/AIDS-free generation. They're also very comprehensive. I like to think of the MDGs as the cornerstones of what developing countries needed, whereas the SDGs really provide a full foundation for any country and what they would need to develop. The unprecedented political inclusivity obviously was a part of the breadth of this agenda, but it also creates a lot of momentum and buy-in, and so countries themselves feel a great sense of ownership over this agenda, and the political commitment that it reflects to end poverty while sustaining and maintaining the Earth's resources, I think is quite powerful. It's also a universal agenda where the MDGs were focused primarily on developing countries, and became much about flows of resources from developed to developing countries. The SDGs are about collective action and shared responsibility. Countries that are at the heart of this and their political leadership really needs to provide the direction, but it's also going beyond just government, and it's really going to need a whole of society effort to achieve the aspirations that the goals set out. This is really development as a political enterprise, and it's going to require private investment. It's going to require countries growing their own domestic resources. It's going to require the participation of civil society as well as other types of investment and philanthropic investment. And I think the last point I'll say is that these goals, whereas the MDGs were very specific and isolated on 8 particular indicators, these goals really highlight integration and how they force countries to think about how you make progress and advance progress on one area of the agenda, not at the expense of another area of the agenda. So when you think about extreme poverty and reducing extreme poverty over the last 20 years, many countries did that with carbon-based economic growth that helped drive that, which then had environmental considerations. And the SDGs really force you to take an integrated approach and to make progress on sustainability considerations at the same time as you're making progress on health. And it also highlights what we've learned about development. For example, we know now that girls' attendance in formal school during adolescence actually is correlated with lower rates of HIV/AIDS. And so taking that into account and understanding that And programming and thinking about strategically how we do that, I think, is extremely important in this agenda and a big difference from the Millennium Development Goals. I think I'll leave it there.
Thank you so much, Tony. We are going to move straight on to John MacArthur now, and just again to say thank you for those of you who are sending in questions via chat, but please continue to do that, and we will address those towards the end of these presentations. John MacArthur is in New York today. Thank you, John, for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Tony, and always a pleasure to be with Tony, who has been such a committed leader on this. And I don't have much to add. I think, Tony, you gave such a great overview of everything. I do have some slides maybe I'll just show to, you know, tack on. They're a little bit making some of the same points, but maybe I would just say that I come at these issues from multiple angles. One is at a personal level, I was quite involved in an official capacity in the early years of the Millennium Development Goal effort and trying to figure out how this notion of taking goals seriously could come to life, which in some ways is hard to imagine that that was the nature of the conversation such a short time ago, but it was. There's a second hat I wear, which is as a senior fellow at the UN Foundation, which just to be explicit is an independent non-governmental organization, but with a very special relationship working collaboratively with the UN to support connectivity to broader constituencies in the world. And then there's a third, which is as an academic and a senior fellow and an economist at the Brookings Institution, I'm very keenly focused on what we can say empirically and quantitatively about these issues and how we can understand with some rigor what is happening and how we can jump from real life to numbers and then back to real life. And so it's in that spirit that I would just share a few basic thoughts. The first is, if we could jump to the next slide, please. You know, these trends, as Tony said, in extreme poverty are, by any stretch of historical timescales, extraordinary. We've been seeing extreme poverty around the world drop by roughly 1 percentage point per year for a generation. And it's en route right now, based on the latest World Bank trajectories, to get down to about 5% of humanity by 2030 on what one might call a business as usual scenario. So even this very first principle of ending extreme poverty has shifted from a seemingly insurmountable task where within probably the lifetimes of most people on the phone, this was at least a third of the world that was living in extreme poverty, down to a question of how would you actually take on the last 5%? And that's a conceptual leap to think about not reducing, but actually eliminating. And it's based on this notion that we are in what I would argue is the fastest rate of progress in history in tackling these very basic human needs around the world. The next slide, if we could shift, please, shows and this is a study that I did, a quantitative study last year, the accelerating rate of progress in child survival. So the dark line here is the actual trend. The top dotted line is what the trend would have looked like if the trajectories of the 1990s had continued. And the middle dotted line there is what the trajectory would have looked like if the trends of the turn of the century had continued. And what we see is that this curve has actually been bending downwards. And as some of you might know, UNICEF and World Health Organization put out new numbers today where they show that hard line has actually now gone below 6 million. It's down to about 5.9 million. And we are, and I'm actually, just as a footnote, about to update these acceleration numbers for next week, that what we're seeing is that this is what I would call the ultimate bottom line measure of progress in development, because it's not a relative measure. Is a dollar a day the right measure of poverty? Is $2 a day the right measure? This is a measure that every human being in the world can rally around, which is, does your child survive to see their fifth birthday? And we've seen that after decades of stagnation, especially in the poorest countries, the past 10 years in particular has been the first time that all countries at all levels of income are able to see the same rate of progress. And if we jump to the next slide, one of the great surprises to many people is that the greatest gains, the big bends in those curves, are actually in Africa. So roughly three quarters of the global gains have been based on ground level breakthroughs from entrepreneurial practitioners and governments and clinicians all around the continent with global partnership, who have been saving many million lives. And the most conservative estimate as of last year's data is that at least 7.5 million more children are alive today than if even that that middle curve on the previous slide had continued. And again, as I was mentioning, I'm updating these numbers for next week, and using the latest data, the numbers are going to be even significantly bigger, it looks like. So we've seen, and by rough estimate, I think at least 15 to 20 million more people are alive today than if the world hadn't been taking this on. And what you also see here is that a lot of people think, oh, all the progress is just due to China. Well, China's progress, notwithstanding the past few weeks, has been extraordinary. But even if we look at the income poverty target, the estimates, the best available data, suggest that if you hold China out of the equation, the rest of the world this year has also achieved the millennium goal of cutting extreme poverty by half. And we see that every region in the world has at least turned the tide on a problem that, again, 15 years ago seemed in many cases insurmountable. So this nature of extreme and extraordinary, pardon me, I should say, extraordinary progress on extreme problems is quite profound. The flip side, if we could jump to the next slide, please, is exactly as Tony said, that the problems are growing, in my view, just faster than the rate of progress. And so this is the graph that many of you probably know of the CO2 emissions. We're now, for the first time in millions of years, above 400 parts per million on a regular basis. And the flip side of the progress is, it's just the nature of the beast, such as it is until today, is that for all of those economies that are growing, all of those societies that are making tremendous economic progress, they're doing so with the corollary of pumping out carbon into the atmosphere. And that's a problem that we have to take on next. And we have to not just solve the problem, but change the way we do business in order to solve the problem, and literally change the way we do business. And so this is part of, I think, the essence of these new sustainable development goals, what are being called the global goals for simple form. And if we then shift to this next slide again, please, we can see that, you know, these goals are not, in my view, these are about the second half writ large. They're about the second half of extreme poverty. They're about the second half of the issues that the world needs to take on. The Millennium Goals were not very successful in the environment. They did not include things like oceans, which are so fundamental. They did not include climate. They did not include things like inequality, which to many of our surprise has become one of the single most salient political issues in all corners of the globe. But crucially, they also take on, as Tony said, the second half of the world. These are about each country's issues on this agenda, not just some countries' issues. And I would argue that they finally take on the second half of society, because when we look at issues like responsible production and consumption or sustainable cities and communities, these are not just government questions. These are not NGO questions. These are equally private sector questions. These are equally scientific questions. And we need, again, new forms of technology, new forms of doing business, and a new layer of aspiration to build on the success we have to make sure that the the rate of progress wins out over the rate of expansion of problems. And one thing I would just say as maybe an anecdote, but one that I found really crystallized things for me is when these targets were confirmed by Tony and all the other negotiators from the other 193 countries around the world, you know, my first reaction was, wow, after the most inclusive global process in history to set a global agenda, this seems to me a slightly Churchillian outcome. Churchill's famous quote on democracy is the worst form of governance except for all the rest. This was, you know, a messy but ultimately kind of reasonable list of issues. But I described it to, of all people, my mother that night. I said, Mom, or my mom is a terrific person that doesn't really understand what I do, of course, day to day, but she's very supportive. And I said, these goals that people have been working on, the end of extreme poverty and all that, they finished today. And she said, oh, that's great. That sounds good. I said, there's only one problem. She said, what's that? I said, there's 17 of them. And I don't know how to explain it. And she said, 17, that's a great number. I said, why do you say that? You're the first person to say that. And she said, it sounds like they didn't take it. The world's complicated. If they put it all down into some Letterman-style top 10, I might not believe it so much. But the world's just complicated. And it's funny, and I tell that story because in the past couple of weeks, I told it to other people and in the, both public audiences and privately, and I think that the point is resonant because we are dealing with a set of complex challenges. And people have said back to me, you know, the world is complicated. We can't pretend to oversimplify the nature of the challenges in front of us. We need to raise our game in order to tackle them with full sophistication. But also, we need to respect the public's understanding of the nature of complexity. And these are big issues that require both complexity of organization, that requires sophistication and respect for the different nature of each problem in each part of the world. And also they need, I think, a broader sense of how everything is so interconnected because these elements of progress do often come with flip sides of challenge and vice versa. So I'll stop there, but I would say that these goals are ultimately, as a final point for now, about framing the challenge as it looks today. And the challenge ultimately comes down to these very nice points in my view that, again, Tony and his fellow negotiators came up with in the preamble of the new document, which referenced people, planet, and prosperity. And I think that ultimately this is an agenda that the world can rally around because the global community understands that we need all three things. We need to promote all three. And that, I think, is what is exciting, but it's also a conversation that the world's about to have in terms of how do we actually organize to do that. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, John. And I'm going to turn to my colleague, Jen Pace, here in the Kaiser Washington office for a quick third presentation, and then we'll move to the questions which are coming in. Thank you very much. Keep them coming.
Great. Thanks, Penny, and to Tony and John. Thank you so much for your contributions and thoughts on this. What I'll do is drill down a little deeper on the health components of the SDGs, although as both Tony and John said, it's really hard to separate or isolate out one concept within the SDGs from others. They're all very interconnected. And I also want to reiterate some things that have been said that are really important to understand about the shift from the MDGs to the SDGs. Seen in the first slide really just represented by numbers from smaller number of goals to more goals, from a smaller number of targets to more targets, you know, all indicators and down the line. One way to think about it with numbers, but really the way I think about it, it represents a major transition in the view and approach to global health and development that's happened just in the past 15 years. From a time when the MDGs were created where there was very little global attention to the growing health problems of the day, to really a revolution in the approach that you could mark by not just the MDGs, but the creation of PEPFAR, of the Global Fund, of Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, and other things that are just quite remarkable in this trajectory of change. They also are a real move from a very focused agenda. The MDG agenda was very focused to a much more comprehensive one, and a move from what I see as a view of the relationship between donor and recipient, or developed and developing, or us and them model, to an all of us approach. And this is really marked just in many ways, both by who created these goals, from an MDG very small, more elite group, to a much more inclusive, and as John said, messy sometimes process, but one that was much more democratic and involved civil society, certainly in the health sphere, but in all spheres at a level that we've not seen before. So it's really been a move from a more narrow view of development to a much more universal one, which emphasizes addressing inequities and inequalities and this concept of leaving no one behind, which frankly was just not there before. And this move, I think, from many analyses was definitely facilitated by the MDGs themselves, as well as what came after them. It also, just to put some reality around this, this all has been occurring at when there was a move initially from a time of rising budgets that more easily supported a growing emphasis on health and an expanding agenda, to a time of austerity and financial constraints. So that's just a real parameter that we all have to address. And also the MDG agenda, while formally ending shortly, is not finished. So turning to the health, going to the next slide, this is just a visual comparison, just again, just focusing on health and isolating it to some extent artificially. In the MDGs, there were three goals, the lighter blue, that were focused directly on health. And in the SDGs, so that's about half almost. In the SDGs, there's one health goal, but there are many others that obviously touch so much on health, zero hunger, gender equality, that are interconnected, but there's one dedicated health goal. And going to the next one, looking at that health goal, which is goal number three, the goal itself is to ensure healthy lives and promote well-being for all at all ages. And I'm sure Tony or others who are more involved in the backstory could say how to get that phrase and how it finally was agreed to is a long, long story, but that's what it is, and it's fairly inclusive. And it includes nine targets that actually include all of the MDG elements that were health-specific. And it also includes, I don't know if this came up earlier, but for each of the areas of the SDG goals, there are means of implementation, so it's not just here are our goals. There's other targets that are really about how are we going to make those goals happen, but these are just the targets. Four of the nine of these actually have specific numbers associated with them, so it's not just maternal mortality, but how you reduce, what you're going to do to reduce the global maternal mortality ratio, for example. Not all do, and some have a target year. Again, not all do. So this slide just presents all of that. What's going to come next is indicators. And so all of these are good, but I think everyone knows that what you measure gets done. And so now the ongoing conversations are, what are the specific indicators that are going to be agreed upon to measure each of these targets? And right now there's over 200 that are being looked at. And for the health area specifically, there are 16 that are highly recommended suggested. So going forward, a key question will be financing the SDG agenda, and part of the reason this has become such a critical issue is that the traditional source of financing when the MDGs were first created, the international community was the traditional source, donor governments, development banks, to some extent the private sector and NGOs, is flattening out. And you can see this in the next slide. These are data from Chris Murray and his team at the Institute of Health Metrics and Evaluation, looking at development assistance for health from all sources. And you can see, you know, the MDG revolution starting in 2000 and on, with a dramatic increase in funding for health from external sources that has begun to flatten out. Everyone, I think, has agreed that it's not going to be these sources that are going to have the solution, but these are a key part of the story. The last slide, just to bring it a little bit closer to the U.S., the U.S. represents about 30% of all international support for health. And the U.S., too, has also been sort of stagnating in the amount that's available. So I think going forward, how this broader agenda gets financed is going to be a key question. And it's certainly not all about money, but that's going to be an issue. So pulling this all together, I guess I would just make a few closing comments. I think there's a lot of cautious optimism about the health focus and the SDGs, that the idea that there's a recognition of leaving no one behind and encompassing not just the traditional health challenges, HIV, TB, and malaria, but new ones, non-communicable diseases, pollution, things that everyone is recognizing now are just as integral to the health of the world, are on there. On the other hand, there's concern, is the agenda so expansive that prioritization will be hard for countries? And how are countries going to prioritize this health agenda? Who's going to monitor this? How are we going to hold countries and others accountable? And I just mentioned that's where civil society becomes really important. And then finally, what are the indicators that are going to be developed and agreed upon and measured over time, and the data for them? So these are just some of the questions that I think should be considered within a broader frame, but I do believe there's a lot of cautious optimism that there is about to be very soon, in a couple of weeks, a global consensus on a very comprehensive and forward-looking health and anti-poverty agenda for the next 15 years that I don't think many of us would have envisioned a decade ago. So I will just end there and look forward to everyone's questions.
Thank you. Thank you to all the panelists for covering what is, I think we've all gathered, a complex set of issues in a relatively short period of time. Just to be clear, we will be posting a transcript and an audio version of this, so you will have the chance to go back and check any bits that you may have missed or need to be clarified. Please continue to submit questions, and we're going to get to those now. I am just going to start with a fairly essential question, given that it's the first of the goals, from Jean Whelan at the Wall Street Journal. Maybe, Tony, you could start with this. How do you define extreme poverty?
So extreme poverty in the agenda itself is defined by income, and so it's, in fact, I think it's target 1.1, which is eradicate extreme poverty, currently measured as people living on less than $1.25 a day. So it is, when we talk about extreme poverty, we're talking about consumption, those that are living on $1.25 a day. I will say, though, that overall this agenda also broadens out into poverty in all its dimensions and has an aspect. And so when you look at goal one itself, the actual goal before that target on extreme poverty is about ending poverty in all its forms everywhere, which is actually quite ambitious because it starts to take into account different dimensions of poverty. But when we talk about extreme poverty and we talk about ending it in this generation by 2030, which is really, I think, at the moral center of this agenda, it's as defined as $1.25, people living on $1.25 a day.
Sure.
And John, you might want to, because there might be work that's going on to shift that.
John, do you want to add to that? I
mean, we may have lost John. Yes, sorry, I was muted. I was responsibly muted for a moment. Excuse me. I was just going to say that exactly as Tony said, the $1.25 a day, that's a purchasing power parity measure that's based on, there's a whole technical history of that number, but it's based on the poverty line in the 15 poorest countries in the world, which are in turn based on roughly the actual, what you need to eat to stay alive, roughly speaking. So it's a very core measure of the worst forms of poverty in the world. The actual number and the best way to put a current U.S. dollar equivalent parity number to that in purchasing power terms is a matter that is an ongoing technical review. So we presume based on the latest purchasing power parity estimates that have come out in the past year that there's going to be a new assessment and a new number that's used to update that. But the core concept will be the same of really the most dramatic forms of extreme poverty. And that this goal, I would say, is really understood as the first among equals of the whole goal, of the whole process of eliminating that. The second target in the whole structure. And these 169 targets, the way I count it, there's really 107 outcome targets and then 62 kind of procedural targets on how to get there. And the second of these core outcome targets is, as Tony said, to cut at the national poverty line level in all countries, poverty by half, and so by 2030. So it's an absolute for the world to eliminate extreme poverty, and then it's a proportionate for each country. But the other thing I would add here, just to make sure it's explicit, is that these are all aspirational targets. There's no binding element to this. These are things that countries have all agreed to aspire to. so there's no punishment that a country gets other than the failure to achieve the goal, if it doesn't achieve the goal. But I think the power of these voluntary commitments is that the idea is so compelling unto itself that one can't argue against it. So who can argue against eliminating extreme poverty by a reasonable metric by 2030? No one I know. And so the real question is, how do you create space for people in communities and countries and provinces and states and towns around the world to figure out on their own terms how they're going to get there? And the clarity of the target is what enables that to really happen in hopefully a powerful way.
I'm now going to move to a question from James Reinel at Al Jazeera in New York. And in a sense, John, actually, you addressed this when you gave us the anecdote about your mother. I am going to start, Tony, with you, because I'm sure you have been faced with this challenge. If you imagine that you are talking to an elderly relative or man in the street with no background knowledge of the SDGs, could you explain in the most simple jargon-free language possible what they considered, what you would consider to be the most important issue to relay about these new UN targets?
I mean, I think it's a, as John mentioned, it is a political commitment that world leaders are making to end poverty and its related indignities while at the same time sustaining and maintaining the Earth's ecosystems and resources. I mean, I think that's at the core of it. And you can think of it almost in terms of extreme poverty, extreme inequality, extreme climate. It's the intersection of those particular issues. And that gets to the core of it. And as John just mentioned, I mean, I think you really have at the moral center of this the amazing opportunity that we have, that we are actually on the cusp of ending extreme poverty within a generation by 2030. I mean, it's something that the president has really, you know, committed to from a U.S. perspective. I mean, he's mentioned it now three times running in the State of the Union address that we as the U.S. will partner with others to end extreme poverty in our lifetime. And it's an amazing, it's almost an underreported phenomenon, the amazing progress that we've made on this, and that we are literally within reach. We are on the cusp. And as John even showed with some trends, even just doing business as we do it today, we'll get down to 5%. So bending that curve with a greater political commitment and some greater focus, you know, we are truly within reach of what would be an astounding human achievement. And I think that is at the basis of these goals and at the moral center. At the same time, I think that point and Jen picked up on this as well, that point about integration, where we have to do this at the same time as being sensitive to improvements that we want to make in the world and make progress on those at the same time as we're making progress around issues of poverty and it's and things that are related to it, like those indicators on health and education and water and sanitation and other things. I think it's extremely important. And I also think these take into account something that we really know now from a development perspective, that the best way out of extreme poverty is inclusive economic growth. And so it is about growth, and it's about growth that reaches those that are the most vulnerable, are most marginalized, and doing it in a way that that includes sort of that economic activity for those that are at the lowest end of the scale. And somebody mentioned that leave no one behind mantra. I also think that's a major difference between the MDGs and the SDGs, whereas progress on the MDGs, you could say, because they were relative indicators, you could target those that were closest to getting you over the line that we had set for ourselves on the MDGs. The SDGs force us to go deepest and to go to the furthest behind because we really are going the last mile to be able to achieve the SDGs that we're putting out. So I hope that's helpful in sort of shedding light on how to encapsulate the different mantra. As John put out, there's people, planet, prosperity. I would add peace and partnership into that, so that you have all the dimensions as a shorthand. But I really think it's about, you know, ending poverty and its indignities while sustaining and maintaining the planet's resources and its ecosystem.
Jenny.
Yeah, I guess I would just add, because those are, there's not much more to add, but to the sort of person on the street who doesn't really know any of this and is probably hearing bits and pieces on the news of lots of strife in the world and conflict and questions about borders, this is a real good news story. This is about, you know, putting all that aside for a second, the world leaders in a consensus way are coming together to jointly have agreed on this important agenda for the global community. So it's a real end extreme poverty and all of its associated challenges, that there's agreement on this in a very big way, in a profound way, is a really important marker of what that power of coming together can do amidst all of these other challenges. And so I would just add that in, because I think the average person in the street would want to know that, since there's so much negative things happening around the world right now.
And, of course, the interesting thing is that this discussion will immediately follow on from the address that the Pope will give to the Assembly, which presumably may touch on these questions, too. I am going to now take a question from Claire Provost in London from the UK Centre for Investigative Journalism. And, Tony, this is initially for you, but I think all three, please, would address it. Why do you think the private sector, including some multinational corporations, have been interested in getting involved in the post-2015 agenda? And to what extent did the U.S. consult with American companies when defining its positions on the SDGs?
Well, certainly we engaged with private sector as well as we did with civil society and others, because I think it goes back to one of my earlier comments. The breadth and the ambition of this agenda really requires us, and this is the way in which actually this administration has also been approaching development, it really requires us to be a whole of society endeavor. So it's going to require government resources. Yes, it's going to require political leadership and political will on behalf of leaders of governments. But by the same time, the resources are going to have to go beyond what governments themselves can provide. I think that's one of the reasons why the private sector is engaged. They see a role, actually. I think they also see that question of sustainability is something that they're struggling with, I think, themselves from their own perspective of businesses. How are they going to maintain and continue to grow over time, and what do they need to be challenging themselves in terms of sustainability? And they see the convergence with the goals themselves. And then, frankly, they also likely see opportunity in emerging markets and markets that are and areas of the world that are growing. Africa has a coterie of some of the fastest growing economies in the world, but are interested in economic transformation and economic growth that really reaches those who are most vulnerable within their countries. And so how can we find the intersection between private investment and private business to both stimulate and maintain development gains over time in a way that's sustainable economically, and that's also sustainable environmentally. But from our own perspective, so for example, when you look at some of the president's signature initiatives on development, look at something like Power Africa, which is about meeting energy poverty in Africa. We put through official development assistance and other public investments, about $7 billion on the table. But we have leveraged up to almost $32 billion additional dollars from that $7 billion, and $20 billion of it has been from the private sector. And when you're looking at large-term infrastructure like energy and bringing energy access and sustainable energy to those that don't have it, you are going to need resources that go beyond what government can provide. And so you can unlock that through these sort of multi-stakeholder partnerships. And I think that's just one example of the type of things that Jen was even talking about Gavi and the Global Fund and what it's meant to global health. And I think we are continue to look at, you know, how you stimulate science, technology, innovation around these particular issues. And again, I think that goes back to what can we do in partnership with private sector and private investment.
John and Jen, do you want to touch on this
yeah,
too?
Yeah, I was thinking that when the question came up about, at least in the health side, but also brought more broadly in development, there really has been a concerted shift and change in the conversation around the private sector. And the Global Fund and Gavi are perfect examples where you engage the private sector not just after the fact, but in creating these institutions, in financing these institutions, in leading these institutions, and the results are seen. And I think a broader point that Tony made earlier is the realization that inclusive economic growth is, you know, all boats rise up. I think that is the private sector sees that. It's whether it's self-interested, economically driven, as well as their sense of being part of a global community, it really has made the case to the private sector writ large of involvement in this in a way that, you know, wasn't there 20 years ago, 15 years ago.
John?
I would just add a couple of points on this. I think one is, like we've seen in the global health revolution of the past 15 years, you know, there are many private sector leaders who, as individuals and human beings, simply want to be part of the solution. Whether that's about, you know, organizing for new technologies, making products available in new ways, collaborating with government for new financing mechanisms to make products available to people who wouldn't otherwise have access, lots and lots of those things. But at the same time, I would say that there's the flip side, which is the basic need of this. And if we think about, just to give a sense of orders of magnitude, the rough estimates of the incremental investments needed to bring all of these successes to life is on the order of $1 to $2 trillion a year. That sounds at first blush like a big, scary number, unless you think about it, just to put it in perspective, on roughly an $80 trillion global economy, it's actually a pretty small share. But if you compare at the other end of the spectrum to, say, if every developed country in the world were to fulfill the target of 0.7% of national income for official development assistance or foreign aid, that would only work out to about $350 billion a year. So these numbers and the nature of the investment are in some ways much bigger than anything an old school, if you will, aid budget would ever be able to take on. But they're also different in their nature, and they're different in their composition. And they're about these issues like how do you make the right investments that will garner and generate the right technologies and products to help support new ways of doing things. And there's a role of basic science in that, which typically tends to be publicly funded, like the National Institutes of Health. There's a role for the venture capital community. There's a role for the, institutional investors and so forth. And one of the big issues here in this interwoven ending poverty and promoting prosperity side, the great example, I would say, the biggest ticket numbers on this are around energy infrastructure for the world. So maybe $600 billion to $1 trillion a year of incremental investment is needed in energy infrastructure to build the smart cities, all the rapid urbanization around the world, to, you know, help create the environment for the jobs, get the power for the companies, all of these basic things. Much of that money, if not most of that money, is going to be private capital. And it'll depend on the country and the level of development and all those things. But, you know, there are institutional investors and pension funds and others that make these long-term investments in things like power plants. And so the question on one hand is, how do we make sure that the power plants and the energy systems are getting built where we want them to get built? Or where the countries want them to get built in order to boost their economies. The other side of it, though, and this is, again, this interwoven challenge at every step, is how do we make sure those are low-carbon power plants? How do we make sure those are low-carbon energy systems? What are the incentives that the local government or the international institutions might be able to provide to crowd in that extra bit of financing that might help make sure that we bend the curve on the carbon trajectory. And so this is a classic example on a very profound issue where we need to align the incentives of the public investments and the private investments in order to solve the mix of problems in front of us. And the final thing I'd say on this is that in many parts of the world, there's still a concern that the business community is not yet very engaged in this. And also in other parts of the world, there's a concern that that maybe the business community should not be overly engaged in this. And just to be clear, I'm Canadian, so I come from that part of the world at a personal level. But there are many issues of what are the fair standards for investment? What are the fair standards for measuring corporate performance, whether that's on ecosystem footprint, labor standards, energy usage, all these things, but also what are the fair ways to recognize companies that make huge contributions through the normal course of business? And this is part of the complexity, but also the power of this agenda, I think, to take on those questions with a much clearer head over the next 5 to 10 years.
I'm going to turn back to Tony for a moment, but before I do that, I just want to add what is a related question, really, from Vivian Russell, based in London at the Public Finance International. She's asking, does the shift to a broader, more inclusive development agenda need to be matched by a parallel shift in financing away from traditional aid flows, which is effectively what we've really been talking about now?
That's interesting because that's a little bit of what I wanted to come back and comment on. I do think that the collective action and the shared responsibility elements of the SDGs really reflects the change even in the global economy. The message that I heard from countries over and over again as we were engaging in dialogue and discourse and putting the agenda together is that they really are have ownership of their own development. They are leading that development. And so it wasn't a question which I think the MDGs were a little bit predicated upon about aid and the being an aid recipient and how you could maximize and sort of optimize the impact of aid. But it was about we are interested in leading our own economic transformation and doing the things necessary both from a policy perspective as well as sort of our own institutions and governance and our infrastructure to be able to really stimulate the kind of economic growth that will do the things that the SDGs lay out, both in terms of poverty reduction, but also in terms of growth and in terms of meeting some of the multiple strands of the goals. And what that really, and it also reflects, frankly, the shift in financial flows worldwide. I mean, in the 1960s, official development assistance going from developed to developing countries made up 71% of the external flows that developing countries received in terms of financial flows. That number is like now down to 9% because you've had an incredible growth of foreign direct investment. You've had the growth of philanthropic giving and remittances. There's just a much greater mix of financial flows. And during the time, like even over the last 10 to 15 years, the amount of domestic resources that that developing countries has almost tripled. And so they have more of their own resources and they're continuing to mobilize more resources domestically and are interested in doing that. And so that does speak to a more nuanced and varied approach to how we use artificial development assistance. Now for the poorest countries and those that have the least access to outside financing, ODA, which is the common acronym for our aid, is extremely important. It provides them, and it's primarily grant-based from the U.S. perspective, and it provides them a way to be able to finance some of the human and social development programs that we're talking about. But we're also increasingly using our ODA as a way to leverage and catalyze other resources. And so I spoke a little bit about Power Africa, and that's just one example of how we've been using our own aid, and even as we've been providing funding to the Global Fund, for example, we've been doing it on sometimes a matching basis, and so it crowds in other types of investment. And I really think it also speaks to, and there are increasingly innovations in even the type of public investments that we're making available. And so rather than just giving direct grant-based aid to developing countries, you know, we are increasing the amount of ways in which we use our public investment to reduce risk through things like loan guarantees, so that private sector investment can happen more readily, for example, and looking for ways to create partnerships in which we do that. And I think that is increasingly going to be, I think you'll continue to see innovation in that regard. I think you'll continue to see ways in which we sort of look for ways to maximize the return on investment that we're providing through our official development assistance. And as John said, you know, we're going to have to unlock resources across many different sectors and maximize the impact of those resources for the sustainable development gains that we're putting out. And I think it's just increasingly reflective of how the world economy has changed and we're developing countries and their progress, what it's brought us as well.
I hate to end on a rather more skeptical note because this is in a way extremely encouraging and a different story than some of the headlines that one sees. So this is James Rimmel again at Al Jazeera, who's asking, the Middle East was faring quite well on the MDGs. Then the Arab Spring happened, followed by conflicts in Libya, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, and derailed the progress. So what is the point of expecting this region to achieve a set of global SDG targets against such a worrying backdrop of war, instability, and refugees? And again, I'm sorry, because I feel that we've focused on what could even seem rather utopian, but I think very realistic goals, and now we're dragging ourselves back to the headlines and reality.
Well, and I think it's a good entree, though, into the recognition of something we haven't talked about, but that is the recognition in the SDGs of the importance of peace and peaceful and inclusive societies, as well as the stability and strength of governance and how that governance needs to be responsive to its citizens. That was not something that was part of the original MDGs. Goal 16 in the SDGs captures many of those elements, as well as there are other things in the goals themselves that also focus attention on communities and populations that also need to have that attention to be able to be included in progress. And so I do think that one of the power that we've learned and one of the lessons that we've learned of the MDGs is that, one, it gave a real platform for discourse between citizens and countries about what progress meant. And I think having those elements of peace and governance is really important because it will provide a platform for conversation around that. It will also provide a platform for driving some standard ways of measuring progress around that. And the MDGs were very helpful within the health community, actually, on coming to some international standardization and agreement on what metrics ought to look like and how we gather and collect that data. And I think it will do the same for some newer parts of the agenda. And I think it's a really important point because when you look at progress on the MDGs, those countries that fared worst and struggled to meet even one MDG were typically countries either coming out of conflict or continuing to be in conflict or which had still some instability or some weakness in the institutions that they have as a government to be able to provide services and protection for their people. And so I think the agenda at least forces us to recognize and to focus political attention and effort in that area. And it's something that, you know, over the next 15 years, hopefully will continue to keep elevated the importance of those issues to our overall development progress.
Can I make just two quick points on this? I know we're getting into time, but one is I would say that there are many issues in here which are risk mitigators for exactly the types of problems that we don't want to see. So if we look, for example, at climate change, the top journals in the world now show that places with higher variants of extreme weather events, temperature, precipitation, are at higher risk of conflict and violence. This is a deep apparent truth in the data that might even well be universal, that there are risks to climate change, and there's even debate around the extent to which this helps explain some of the trends in Syria itself, that we in leading journals. But we see that these are about not just solving the problem as it exists in its acute form, but tackling the undercurrents and even the issues of inequality in many countries, some argue, are fundamental to that. But the deeper point I would say is when we think about these goals, these are ultimately starting points, not finishing points. These are about identifying a set of North Stars so that everyone can row in the same direction, at least when it's dark outside, and it feels dark outside. And this is about how we can build whether it's public-private partnerships, whether it's the scientific collaboration, whether it's the community working with the national government, whether it's the regional cooperation, whether it's the international system, whatever it might be, getting the different actors to think about a common purpose. And that's why this incredibly inclusive process to get to where we are today is so important, because it has been the most inclusive global agenda-setting conversation ever to take place. And so the people who worry about oceans are typically their own community. The people who worry about urban infrastructure are typically their own community. They now can all see, and so on, each community, how they fit together into this common agenda in a way that's never been possible before either. But in the moment of celebrating the global political victory of coming to this common agenda, we do have to underscore, I think, just how much work lies ahead of us to solve these problems. And these goals, if used right, in a self-fulfilling manner that we do decide, all of us, to take them seriously, they become a way for us to keep honest in our own conversations with ourselves and with each other about, you know, are we solving the problems that we said we're going to solve, and what do we need to do better, and what's the transparent feedback mechanism, and how are we actually doing on the things that we said we care about, because we promised to track this in a serious and earnest way for the next 15 years.
Thank you, John. As we wrap up now, Tony, do you just want to make any final thoughts?
Yeah, just to take a step back a bit. 2015 as a year is really a year of development for political leaders and for governments. We had a conference in July on financing for development, which actually touched on many of the things we were talking about around financing and fed in to this consensus that we got on the SDGs. And then in December, you will have the COP and climate change, you know, being a big part of the agenda. And so this really has been an important year when we talk about development and the sustainable aspects of development, and where there's an intersection between reducing poverty and the commitment to reducing extreme poverty and sustainability concerns. As well as, I will say, the upcoming 2 weeks or towards the end of September will bring a extreme spotlight on the political moment for this to be part of the of how we bring the world's attention to issues of development and sustainable development. You'll have the Pope's visit to the U.S. He'll address both Congress and then immediately after the U.N. In fact, he addresses the U.N. the morning before the summit for sustainable development kicks off at the U.N. That will run for a couple of days in New York. There will be the state visit from the Chinese president to the White House as well. And you have an opportunity really to focus, and there will be large public relations efforts that are trying to make the world aware of these particular goals and the meaning that they can have, and what John was just so eloquently talking about, what the political commitment and that global consensus around these goals can mean for the world, and how citizens can be involved. And I think it's just a real opportunity to share some of the good news story, frankly, and for people to be more aware of even in what can be best described as very complicated and sometimes times of turmoil, that the world, as the world's governments have really worked hard to come up with a global consensus around these issues, and are making a political commitment to really achieve the aspirations that are reflected in these goals. And I think that's quite extraordinary and astounding. And I think the political moment will be quite exciting.
Well, thank you to our panelists for covering this so clearly. We will have a recording of today's presentations on our website later today, and a transcript should be available in the coming week. I'm sorry for a few questions that did not get addressed. We will try and follow up with you afterwards. And there's Katie's email if anybody has additional questions you'd like to send our way. Thank you for being part of this, and I hope you find it helpful as you look ahead to your reporting on these issues in a couple of weeks' time. Thank you for joining us today.